So let me begin. This is the last night with the Nitziv, so we're going to finish it, even if I have to go an extra half hour. Of course, if you have to go off, you can always listen to the classes later, where they sent out a day later. And I do want to, I received a number of emails, so let me just take care of this, spend maybe 10, 15 minutes with that, and get right into the Nitziv in no particular order. Baruch, I'll start with you. You'll be very happy with this. We had this conversation two classes ago about Litvish davening, and on Shabbos, I found a whole story of how the Papa Rav of Yosef Greenwald, they call him now a Rebbe, but Papa was never a Hasidus in Europe. He became a Hasidus, as did other things. He talks about how, and this is, you can find this in the Taras Yom Tov of Hananya Yom Tov Deutsch, and on volume 8, page 200. He talks about an issue he had with the Chazon Ish, and it's very interesting because he was debating something with the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish, he mentioned the rush to the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish gave an explanation. And then, lo and behold, he finds out that the Chazon Ish in his own sefer gave a different explanation. And when he spoke to the Chazon Ish really wasn't aware of that rush. Oh, he wasn't on top of that rush, I should say. And it shows that the Chazon Ish even could forget what he wrote about. But he said that he stayed with the Chazon Ish, and he says, "Hold on a second. I think someone's telling me. Someone's trying to get on. Now, hold on a second. I'm going to tell him to try again. He wants to know if I started yet because he wants to get on. Okay, so he says, he palalti, he says, I daven with the Chazon Ish, minyashlo, and he says about the Chazon Ish, v'herich b'tfilaso, ki hit palel mila b'mila. He says, the Chazon Ish daven very slowly, word by word. So here we have an example of the Chazon Ish davening very slowly. So now you're asking me, how would I? Am I just sitting reading the Taras Yom Tov? Taras Yom Tov is he's the one who changed mikvahos in America. Mikvahos in America, not just in America, but in America outside of New York, they all used regular plumbing. That was, and he really he changed it. So now I don't think there's any mikvahs left in the country that still did the old way. But the mikvahs in America, the mikvahs in Morocco, the mikvahs in the cities, and in North Africa, they used regular. And if you know, Rabbi Amsalam created a big controversy last week when he suggested that because of this controversy now, because of this coronavirus, maybe people have jacuzzis, they're big enough, they have 40 seconds. And they could use the mikvahs, and he was attacked as a reformer and everything. So that's how the mikvahs used to be done years ago. And Rabbi, I mentioned this in a previous class, Rabbi David Miller actually had this idea that everyone should have their own private mikvah. He has a whole book on this. In your own house, you can have it. So, but why would I come across this? I'm not reading this. Well, lo and behold, I didn't. I was reading this. Let me show you what I was reading on Shabbos. If any of you read Yiddish, I think you'll find it interesting. This magazine, their Vicker, which is, I don't know, it's sort of like the Maskilish Hasidim published this, or the Enlightened Hasidim. It's a magazine in Yiddish all about the issues of the day, which doesn't present the standard Hasidish perspective. These are the people who live in the Hasidic world, but many of them are Zionists, they're modern Orthodox. I mean, they look like Hasidim, and they go to the Hasidic show, but there's a whole underground group of these people, including Satmar. When I spoke in Borough Park, some of you listening right now were there with me. In fact, Baruch, who's here, can testify. He actually walked me to a place where a group of Satmar were there to meet me, and we spent a few hours afterwards. So, and this issue, Der Vicker, if that's the person on the front there, he's the guy who just translated Harry Potter into Yiddish. His name is Viswanath. His father is Meoch Viswanath. He's he's a convert from Hinduism. If you're from Teaneck, you know him well. When I was in India, I ran into him. A wonderful family. And he actually studied English as well. He's brought up speaking Tamil and Yiddish. And there's a whole article on him, on his translation of Harry Potter into Yiddish. And in the journal, they had some interesting just pieces in there. And in one of the pieces, it mentions the thing I just told you about the Chazon Ish. The reason I was waiting was, I wish I could stop this. Hold on, I'm turning off the sound here. Someone can't get on. Hold on, I'm gonna send him the link just a second so he can get on again. Hold on a second. I wouldn't want to not. That's the problem when people come on with 1 second to go, and if there's a problem. So let me just send this to him, the link. And then I'm going to tell you something else very interesting. Okay, he might have an old link. Shiner is also having a problem getting on, and Zahav. I don't know. Tech support, maybe you can go in. There's a few people, Shiner and Zahav and a couple others who can't get on. Okay, so in here there's an article, Professor David Fishman, great scholar on East European Jewish history. He's been with us every week. He's not with us now. I wanted to mention this to him. Maybe you'll hear it later, that there's a whole article in here about Hasidic Yiddish by a professor, Isaac Bleeman. He's professor of linguistics, believe it or not, in UCLA Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And in there, he has a picture of Professor Fishman's father, Joshua Fishman, who was a great, great scholar of linguistics. And that's there. Now, I like Vekker very much. It's one of my favorites. Because a couple of years ago, lo and behold, look who they put on the cover of it. And you can buy this on Amazon if any of you Yiddish readers are interested. Okay, so leave that aside. Let's move on. One of you asked me about the sale of chametz. When I said it's not a real sale, what do I mean by that? Well, of course, it's a sale. The sale is valid. However, I explained why it's not real because, in fact, I'm looking, it's not what we think of normal sale because I have a shtar to sell it somewhere here. Oh, and it says you pay 5 cents per person and the rest you pay at the end of Yom Tov. But it belongs to the person. And yet, Rav Mazuz, in his weekly Parsha sheet, he calls it, he says as follows this week. He says it's, Mechira shelanu is mechira formalit, lo mechira mamash. I actually think maybe in previous years they didn't do this by paying 5 cents. I think they might have sold it completely and then bought it back. If you look in the you see, and what do I mean when I say it's not really a sale? Because if it was really a sale, you could not do what I'm telling you right now. If you open up your Mishnah Berurah, your Shulchan Aruch, to Siman Tuf Mem Chet, do this later after the class. Hilchos Pesach, and you look in the Shari Tshuva. It's in my edition. It's on page Lamed. Your Shari Tshuva, in the Halachas on Halacha Gimel. He tells a story here that once it happened that the non-Jew, remember in those days it wasn't so common, but the non-Jew bought all the schnapps from the Jew, and what did he do on Pesach? He kept going there and kept drinking it and getting drunk. And there doesn't seem to be any assumption here that he has to pay after Pesach. In other words, my assumption here is that he bought it, and then you buy it back after Pesach. So the problem is that they're losing. The man is losing all of his drinks here. So what does it say? This is what the author of the Shari Tshuva says: when the guy gets drunk and he goes to sleep. Take the key away from him. Because in the olden days, and now today it's come back, you have to give the key. Today I don't think we can because we're selling it online. Take the key, and he would think, And then he gives another solution of how to ask to borrow the key, because you have to get something in there. And then Yashmin Atzmo, Oshiyom Rashiyindo. In other words, he's saying that you can take the key to prevent the guy from getting into the drink. Now, normally, as far as I know, you can't do something like that. If I sell something to someone, it's his. I can't then go take the key from him so he can't have access to it. But since the whole point of the sale, and the non-Jew knew that the point of the sale is to sell it back later, that it's only a formality. Therefore, according to the Shari Tshuva, it's not a real sale in the sense that it's technically a real sale, but it's not, in reality, it's not. It's only like a legal fiction type of sale. Therefore, he sees no problem in taking the key so that the guy can't have access to the thing, even though he owns it. He bought it because really, he wasn't supposed to use it. He was supposed to sell it back to you. I don't know if the other post scheme hold of this, but it's right there. So much so that when I told someone about this a few years ago, they didn't believe me. But it's there, black and white, that you can, if the guy's going to eat it, eat your chametz, you can take the key so he can't access it. Chaim is, I don't know if Chaim, yes, Chaim is with us. We mentioned Rabbi Witterwitz last class, and he's an expert on the all the old Hebrew newspapers, and he called my attention to the fact, well, I have a better picture for you. I told the story, remember, that he called himself Chief Rabbi of America, and his question is, well, who made him Chief Rabbi? He said, the sign maker. I thought this was just a joke. I didn't realize, oh, sorry, this is the wrong one. Let me even show you something better. Where is it here? Here, look at this. Here we see he gave Victor van Hashkachas. He actually, on his stationery, called himself Chief Rabbi of America. So thank you, Chaim. It's a famous joke. He said the sign maker, but he actually referred to himself in this way. Furthermore, and he was a Chabadnik, incidentally. He edited the Tzemach Tzedek's Tshuvos. Was it Ephraim Dinard even claimed that he wrote the Tshuvos? Here, if you see it, you can't see it so clearly, but it says Rav HaKol de America. There you have Borden's milk. Okay, two more things before we go on. Shlomo Fischelis, yes, I think he's here with us. Thank you very much. He called. We spoke about the reason for the closing of the Volozhin Yeshiva, and I mentioned how in the yeshiva world, you know, everyone has the story because of secular studies. He called my attention that in Meller, Shimon Meller, who I think that's his first name, who's written all these books on the Briskers and important stuff on Rav Elvel, Rav Chaim. In his book on Rav Chaim, and he sent me pages from the English, he writes that it was closed because the government was concerned about the lawlessness that prevailed there. And he actually refers, you know, a government document that they're talking about this. I mean, I don't think anyone reading it thinks that Meller went back to the government archives. I guess you can't cite Stanford because he's involved in secular studies, universities. So that's no good. But what's important is that you see that even in this standard work now in the yeshiva world about Reb Chaim, the modern scholarship, which is that the yeshiva was closed not because of secular studies, but because of the difficulties, you know, that the students were creating, has made its way into Haredi hagiography, and he cites everything Stanford says, you know, how he was able to open up a couple of years later. Okay. One more thing, and then we'll go on, and then if I have time at the end, I'll come back to other things I want to show you. I mentioned the Maskilim. I couldn't remember the name of one of the Maskilim who taught in Vilna at the seminary, but was also a very, very great Talmud Chacham. Here he... Oops, sorry, not there. Here's the book. I can't. It's not pulling up, but I'll show it to you. You can see it here. It's a book on the commentary on the Brisa of the 32 Midot of the Torah is interpreted by Eliezer. it's Zvi Hirsch Katzenelnbogen, who is a maskil, but also a big Talmid Chacham. You have notes in it by the Rishash and by Rav Matisyahu Strashen and by Rav Bezalel, the Rav of Vilna. So that's an example of one of the religious maskilim I mentioned. The other things, two more things I'll get to at the end. I want to mention it to you. But now I want, this I have to do. Yisrael Kashkin says, I mentioned that the story that Rav Shach said, at least the way I thought I said it, was that he had non-religious grandchildren because he didn't sing Zmiros. It apparently wasn't clear. I didn't speak clearly. That I didn't mean to imply he had no religious grandchildren. He has a daughter who's married to a Rabbi Bergman, who's they're all in the yeshiva world. But he has a son, Ephraim Shach, who became more modern, and his children are not religious. One was a paratrooper, in fact, or an army soldier, not his paratrooper. And that's Rav Shach said he wasn't zocha to have those grandchildren religious, supposedly, he said, because he didn't sing Zmiros. I spoke to this Ephraim Shach once. He came to YU. He had got a PhD or an EDD from YU. He taught at Flatbush. How did I speak to him? Only in the good old days when we had telephone books, everyone was in the phone book. Everyone, politicians, scholars. I just had a question once about Rav Shach, so I looked in the phone book. This takes us back 25 years ago. I called him up, and we had a conversation. Okay, so now let's return. I want to do one more thing in the letters of the Netziv, and then I want to move on. And this is on page 189. This is very relevant to me in particular. It appears also in the Tshuvos, the Meshiv Dover. But I have it right here, so I'll cite it. It's addressed to Rav Moshe Aryeh Bamberger. He was in Kissingen, I believe, from the famous Bamberger family. The question was the great Rav, the Würzburger Rav in Germany, who had the great dispute with Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, with Hirsch believing in separate communities, Austrit, and Bamberger coming to Frankfurt and saying, nope, if the community is going to give in, you can remain with the Reform in one community for the sake of Paul Yisrael. That's the great dispute. We don't need to get into it now, but Rabbi Bamberger was the leading halakhic authority in Germany, the old-time Rav. When I say old-time Rav, because he didn't really have advanced secular education, but he still dressed. He wore the rabbinic gown and everything, but a real important posek from Talmud Chacham of the old school. Same era as Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who we had classes on. Eventually, hopefully we'll have classes on the Würzburger Rav. He left volumes of halachic writings in manuscript. And he never published them in his lifetime, these things, and he didn't want to publish them because he didn't think that either, he didn't want the responsibility. It's a common thing, rabbis don't feel they're worthy to take the responsibility, even though he was the greatest. In Germany, he didn't want to. So the ones that he didn't publish in his lifetime, he left for his children, don't publish them. So the question is, do children need to listen to their father here? Or can they publish them? Do they need to bury them? What's their responsibility? On the one hand, it's Torah. On the other hand, their father was the greatest posek in Germany. On the other hand, their father's telling him not to publish it. Do you have to listen to your father? Especially because maybe these were not halacha maisa, maybe these are just ideas he had. So they turned to the Netziv with this. And again, these were, let me take that back, because what I just said was incorrect. As you see in the letter of the Netziv, the Würzburger Rav said not to print his tshuvot, which he sent out halacha maisa. That is, he sent out responsa to people, and that applied halacha maisa to those people, but he didn't want it to be halacha doros. He didn't want to publish in the Sefer so other people can see it and rely upon it. So what do you do? And the son, this Moshe Aryeh Bamberger, who was also Talmid Chacham and a Rav, he writes to the Netziv that, there's a dispute about when you have a contradiction between the Tshuvot. What do you do when you have a contradiction between the Tshuvot of an author, his responsa, and his halachic writing? So, for example, the Rambam. The Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah. He says one thing, and in his responsa, he says something else. Who do you decide by? Some people say, well, you go by whatever is later. If you know that something's later, it obviously should go. Others say that, no, the Mishnah Torah is, the height of his greatness. You go by this. The same issue is with the Rush. And the common view that has come down is when it comes to the Rush, if there's a contradiction between his responsa, which were practical halacha, versus what he writes in his work of Psakim that you find in the back of all the Gemaras, that you're supposed to go by what's in the Psakim. That's what at least what some say. And the Netziv says no. The Netziv says, on the contrary, when you're writing practical halachic issues, responsa, halacha lemaisa, that you assume that you put more emphasis on it and you go into the issue more and you should rely on that. And if there's a contradiction between what's lemaisa versus what's theoretical, you go with lemaisa. And what about the fact that the son of the Rush, none other than the son of Yehuda, these both of them were in Toledo. So when we do our virtual tour, we'll take you to Toledo. We'll talk about both of them because Rav Yehuda was also a Rav there. Rav Yehuda says you go by the Psakim. You don't go by the actual responsa. The Netziv says no. This is a special case that the son must have known that the Psakim were later than the responsa, and his father retracted it. Not everyone agrees with the Netziv in this, but that's what the Netziv says. And then he goes on and says some interesting things. He mentions that there were great Torah sages who didn't want to publish their responsa. And the reason was precisely because they knew people would rely on it. Not what Rabbi Bamberger says about his father, that his responsa, he didn't reach the height of his greatness, therefore we shouldn't. And it says, no, just the opposite. People don't want to publish it because they didn't want to take the responsibility, and they knew that people would rely on them. And but then he says, does anyone have the right to say that I'm a rabbi, I give a psak, and I publish it, let's say, or I send it to someone to say that, well, in a later generation, people can't rely on me? Is there such a concept that does rabbis do it all the time, incidentally, where they say they publish responsa and they say, but don't rely on me. This is just my idea, don't rely on me. And if you look in the Sde Chemed, I mentioned this in my book on Rabbi Weinberg, the Sde Chemed says that that's just the rabbi being modest, that you're allowed to rely halacha lemaisa on a psak in a sefer, even if after going through the entire psak, the rabbi at the end of it says, but this is all theoretical, don't rely on me. The Sde Chemed cites a number of sources that says that you can take everything throughout, and the last, paragraph or so, or the last line where he says, but don't rely on me, you can ignore that because we assume that the rabbi only says that because he's modest and he doesn't want people to rely on him. But we can rely on him. That's what people have asked how Rav Yecheskel Abramsky has a whole response on permitting gelatin. And at the end of it, he says, but you can't rely on me. And Rav Avad Yosef and others cite him in or the Sicily Ezra, and they rely on him. And people have said, how can you rely on him when he says specifically, this is totally but don't rely on it. And the answer is that this is to the protests of the rabbis. So then the Netziv says, so the Netziv raises this question, and if they could say don't rely on me, then we wouldn't publish the tshuvot of the Würzburger Rav. And then the Netziv says, well, apparently someone can determine what you can do with your own rulings. That is, it's my halachic ruling, I can say so. And he cites some examples, but then he says, no, it's not true. And he concludes that the Torah, he says, my Torah, if I'm Machadesh, it's only mine in the sense that what I can do with it, but I can't destroy it. And he says that it's like by Truma. If I have Truma, I can give it, I can pick which Kohen I want to give it to, but I can't destroy the Truma. And he says it's the exact same thing with Torah, that if it's my Torah, I'm Mechadesh it, I can publish it where I want, I can send it to who I want to, but I can't destroy it because once it's out there, once I've written it, it belongs to Klal Yisrael. He says, Nikreis al shmo, even though it's mine, someone can't plagiarize from me. This doesn't apply to what has to do with what we call Kiyuma Torah. Avalim wrote says to you, Nevadim in Olam, Ze'en Lo Rishus. In other words, I can publish it. I can decide, which journals it appears in, etc. But I can't destroy it because it's given to me. When Torah is created, it's once it's out there, it's now part of, it's all for Klal Yisrael. And then he says, it's true that there are many responsa from the Gaonim that have been lost, but he says that's only because in Shamayim they were not Zocha that the generation would learn from them. And but that's has nothing to do with purposely destroying it. And then he says that the sons of Wurzburger Rav should involve themselves in publishing it. And that's how he ends it. But then he has a couple more paragraphs. You asked me now, sons, once the tshuvot are published, if I should look at them. And he says, we look at them after they're published, but before we distribute them, I guess maybe to add notes on it or say, don't rely on this. And he says, nope, once they're published, it's time to send them out to the world. But then he has a paragraph, which I have to say, I do not understand at all. He says, but since we see that your father, he didn't want to publish his responsa for the generations until the other Gedolim agreed with him, before, it's worth, you should give the tshuva to a certain Gedolim of the generation before they are published. And if these Gedolim find something in it that they don't agree with, Shelo Yehi Mitzkabel Yafe, Tov Yoser Hashmita, better not to publish it. And then he cites something from the Gemara. This is in Bava Basra, a Kuf Lamed, where it's dealing with Rabba and Rav Papa. He says that if you see something I wrote in written form and you have an objection to it, don't rip it up. Speak to me. I can explain it to you. And if it's after my death, don't tear it up, but don't derive anything from it. Don't tear it up because it still could be good Torah. Just because you don't understand it, don't tear it up. I could have explained it to you. But if you don't makes it doesn't make sense to you, don't rely on it. I don't understand, how this is the same thing. The Nitziv is saying to them, before it's appears in print, he says that you should publish it, and don't worry about your father was nervous, but because he was nervous, give it to other Gedolim. If they see it as fine, then we'll publish it. But if they have problems with it, don't publish it. And the proof is this Gemara. But this Gemara doesn't say, just to cover it up and to put it in Geniza. It simply says don't rely on it. So it would appear to me the parallel would be like what it says in Rav Yaakov Ellinger's Tshuvot, some of them, that don't rely on them. That what the Nitziv has said here is that if these rabbis don't think that the Nitziv is correct in his ruling, that don't they think it's a problem, don't publish it. That's I wrote a whole book on this. In other words, censor the tshuva. And I don't see where that's in the Gemara at all. The Gemara is saying don't rely on it. But that's what he says. And this tshuva of the Nitziv, is cited by everyone, and they all cite the beginning part where they say that, we can't cover up what the Gedolim say. The Nitziv already says that even if someone doesn't want it to be published, it has to be published. So when people said, they had the dispute over my publishing, everybody. Weinberg's letters, everyone said, well, the Nitziv already said that even if Rabbi Weinberg himself wouldn't have wanted them published, the Nitziv says they should be published. It's actually not true. He says that, yes, they should be published unless a Gadol, or he says, or a few of them, veto it. And it's, I'm not sure, the Nitziv is speaking only, it's sort of not the typical censorship because the Nitziv is speaking about the specific case where we know that the Wurzburger Rav didn't want his tshuva to be published. And the Nitziv is saying, well, we don't listen, we're going to publish them. But since he was so interested in not publishing them, well, look, maybe there is something radical there, we won't. The censorship that I wrote about, which is almost uniformly where the rabbi publishes the sefer himself, or we have no reason to think that he had any problem with it, and then later generations cover it up. But you do see here that the Nitziv was careful about this. Along the beginning, though, I found something interesting in this book. This is a book of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, a biography of him, and on page, it's called Gaon HaRa'ah, on page 219 and 220, It's interesting that it came up when they wanted to print the responsa of Rav Shulam Leib of Diskin. Rav Shulam Leib Diskin. He was the Rav of Brisk, incidentally. But the problem was his son. He had a son named Yitzchak Yerucham. He didn't want the responsa to be published. It doesn't say who had it, but maybe it was in the Beis Din there. They had responsa from Rabbi Diskin. His son did not want it to be published, so went before the Beis Din with Rashi Pesach Franker. Rashi Pesach Franker, remember, was on the Beis Din of Shmuel Savant, and they ruled that Pinkas Shel Ktavim Shayach B'no HaYoresh, that is, the actual notebook of the Tshuvot belonged to the son. Aval Chidushi HaTorah Atzmam Shayachim L'Kol Yisrael. But the writings, not the physical writings, but the actual writings, they belong to the Jewish people, and the son cannot forbid their publication. The parallel would be if I found in some archive a response of, let's say, of Ramosha Feinstein, or if I bought one, the sons of Ramosha Feinstein could say, well, we want that document. Maybe it was stolen from our house. I would have to give them back the actual document if it's true it was stolen. And if it's not stolen, I don't have to give it back. But they cannot say to me, don't publish it. Rabbi Soloveitchik's children, and one of his son has actually been very makpid on this. According to American law, he can, but not according to what the Beis Din in Jerusalem rules, that you cannot say that it's my father, I'm the inheritor, therefore you can't publish the responsa. It's up to me to determine whether it should be published. And as for Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, he has no children. He has Yorshim, who live in Maryland. They gave me complete authority to publish everything from Rabbi Chiyo Yaakov Weinberg, and therefore no one can come to me and claim that I don't have the legal right. But in terms of the Torah right, we just saw that when it comes to the responsa and other things, writings of the Gedolei Yisrael, that no one can determine, not even the children can say that we don't want it to be published. It's a big problem today because often the children have turned more right wing and they don't want to see, you see this with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's children, that they don't want certain things published that he wrote relating to the State of Israel. He even wrote something about conversion. We'll get to conversion in a minute. And they've covered it up. They've published bolderized versions of his responsa. But if I have a copy of it, I'm allowed to. And I have a copy of responsum from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach dealing with electricity. And I plan on publishing it. And if the son would say, you have no right to publish it, I would say, well, the Beis Din in Jerusalem said, I do have the right to publish it. It's a responsum, incidentally, sent to Rav Yudel Rosenberg, who, in addition to all of his other pursuits with the Golem and all these, he's a creator, really, of the Golem stories. In addition to that, he happened to be a Talmud Chacham, and he wrote, I think, the first book on, even before Shlomo Zalman, I think, or maybe the second, you have to check, on electricity and halacha, and he had a correspondence with Shlomo Zalman, and I have a responsum from Rav Shlomo Zalman to never before appeared in print. So stay tuned for that. Okay, a couple more tshuva. In the Meshiv Dover, an interesting question in Volume 1, number 16, he was asked from Cincinnati, because you didn't have that many great rabbis at the time in America, the Netziv, everyone knows the Netziv, so he was asked from Cincinnati, a shul built a new Aron Kodesh, and the dedication took place on Sunday. And the question was, can you read the Torah on Sunday in honor of this dedication, in honor of the day? Read the Torah with Alios, the whole thing. And he says you can't, as it would be a bracha of a Torah. So then he raises the question, oh, can you take the Sefer Torah out, though, and just read it without brachos? I mean, we had, I mean, there we had a case like this in the town next to where I am, because a kid was supposed to be bar mitzvahed last week, I think it was last week, and he couldn't be bar mitzvahed. It's a big problem. Unfortunately, it's happening a lot. So on Sunday, this is what I was told. I wasn't there. But on Sunday, by Zoom, they took out the Sefer Torah and he read it for his family and the people who couldn't come. And he read through the whole Torah. They didn't tell me he did Aliyahs. He probably stopped for breath after each Aliyah. Is that allowed? It's the same thing, even without brachas. You're reading the whole You're reading the Sefer Torah. Now, I don't extrapolate from what I'm going to tell you the Nitziv to that case, because I mean this is a Shas Adchak. Here you have a bar mitzvah boy who spent a whole year preparing. It's his big day, and all of a sudden the whole day is destroyed, and he can't go to shul and all that. So don't assume that what I'm going to tell you now, the Nitziv's stringent ruling, would apply to the case of the bar mitzvah boy. But it's an interesting question. The Nitziv says, what if you don't have brachos? Can you take it out and read it? So what would possibly be the problem? And I think most people intuitively would say there's no problem. What's wrong with taking out a Torah out of the ark? If you want to take out a Torah, you could read from Torah. And the Nitziv says no. The Nitziv says that we are not allowed to read the Torah publicly on a day there is no reading. And when we do read it publicly, he says to the Yerushalmi that you need to say a blessing on it. But you can't say the blessing on the day that you're not supposed to read the Torah. It's a bracha lova tova. That is the heter for taking out the Torah for bar mitzvah boys. Most bar mitzvah boys, at least in my community, before their bar mitzvah, they meet with someone who takes the Torah out. You read the entire Torah just to see that the kid knows it, so it doesn't make any mistakes. Are you taking the Torah out for no purpose? No, it has a purpose, and but it's not publicly. That's what the Nitziv said. Based on this, you have to ask yourself, is it permissible, as almost all shuls do, to take a Sefer Torah out a few weeks ago and read it for women after davening? Some shuls, they even read it a second time in the afternoon, Parsha Zachar. Are you allowed to do that? And Rav Moshe Feinstein held no. You're not allowed to read the Sefer Torah for women. Why not? For the simple reason that women are not obligated in Parsha Zachar. And therefore, you cannot take a Sefer Torah out and read it for women. Now, when women today go, it's a nice minhag. The minhag is first attested to by Rav Nosson Adler, the Rav of Baskovitz, the teacher of the Chasam Sofer. So this is not a very old minhag. So the women all go, and they make a big deal, and they hear about it. But we read, they're not there often early on, so we take the Torah out again. And the Rav held it wasn't a problem, and I don't think anyone today holds it. Rav Moshe held you're not allowed to. Because you can't read the Torah publicly for no purpose. And I don't know why, if I would, this is recorded in Rav Felder's book, Rav Aaron Felder. If I was with Rav Moshe, I'd ask him, well, it is a purpose because there's a kiyum, so why is it? But he held, it's not Zman of Kriyas Torah. You don't just take a Torah out and read it. It gets even crazier. Last Shavuos, I was out of town, or remain nameless, so maybe some of you would know which I'm talking about. And the Chabad actually, in the afternoon of Shavuos, they had a special reading of the Aseres HaDibros for the people who weren't in shul that morning. It was basically for the women who weren't at shul, because I assume the men were, but men could have gone also. Now, not only is that a problem of the sort that Nitziv and Rav Moshe had, that has a different problem because it's almost the Gemara says you're not allowed to make a big deal about Aseres HaDibros. Reading the Aseres Adibros in that fashion is it's almost Sadducean, I think, and is it's also for a different reason, even though apparently Chabad does it all over the place. But you can only imagine how upset Rav Moshe would be with it, because it's not only about reading the Torah when you're not supposed to, you're dafka making a big deal about Aseres Adibros, where we know from the Gemara that's precisely what you're not supposed to do, is make a big deal of the Aseres Adibros. And we need a whole understanding of what gives us the right to stand up for Aseres HaDibros, but to have a special reading just to read the Aseres HaDibros, that's not what you're not supposed to do. So I find that interesting. Another, but then the minhag, of course, is that we do have a separate reading for the women, and Rav Moshe's opinion, it's not in his Igros Moshe, it's recorded by his Talmud, Rav Aaron Felder. Another tshuva in the Meshiv Davar, volume 5. The volume 5 is, I like volume 5, because most people don't know about Volume 5, because Volume 5 only appeared in 1993, and they didn't publish it separately. They published it as part of the regular volume. So if anyone bought a Meshiv Davar before 93, they don't even know this. They see this in the Sfarim store. They have the Meshiv Davar. And many people are not going to buy a whole new volume just for Volume 5, but Volume 5 has interesting stuff in it. In number 44, you have a tshuva which, I mean, his attack on Rabbi Rinas is almost beyond belief. Rabbi Rinas, who He also was a the founder of the Mizrahi as a political party. I already mentioned Rav Oliver as more of the idea of the Mizrahi. He's a Talmud Chacham, Rav of Lida, and he published. We have a lot of stuff of his in manuscript. You can see it online. The problem is I can't read the handwriting, some of these East European handwriting is very difficult. But he wrote a number of volumes in which he offers a conceptual system of understanding Shas, just like Moshe Mordechai Amiel does. And in one of his books, it's called Urim Gedolim, and it's conceptual, analytic. There's even a whole article I found on him, published in the Journal of Law and Religion, by Yosef Lindell, written when he was a fellow at the Tikva Center, it seems. A science like any other, classical legal formalism and the halachic jurisprudence of Rabbis Isaac Jacob Reines and Moses Avigdor Amiel. What does the Nitziv respond to Rabbi Reines? He thanks him for sending the book, and then he says, however, when I looked at it, I couldn't understand it because of the words and the ideas. And then he says, actually, he doesn't really thank him for sending the book. He says, if I would believe what you're saying is correct, that you've been able to create a new way, Derech Chadash, b'Havayos HaTalmud, a new way of understanding the Talmud, the Hegyonah, and its logic, he said, I would chova alay latzum arba'im yom. He said, I have to fast 40 days to forget everything I've done until now. This is in 1887. He's an old man. I have to fast to forget all my Torah. I've learned Torah now for 80 years, the old way, the traditional way. If what you're telling me is correct, all these conceptual ways of understanding things, I'd have to forget everything. And I have to sit before you to receive this new method. And he says, I would do it. It'd be worth it because the Torah is worth it. Ma'asev, any mommy must I call? He says, but I'm not going to do it because I don't believe that you've created any new method. He said, I've looked in your writings and he says, he criticizes a particular point he makes, and then he says that your books, they were not for people like us who study the way that the rabbis have taught us. He says your books were created to for people who have never tasted, Torah, what it means to be Amel in Torah. Really, very, very, very strong. I'm not going to explain anymore. You're not going to like what I have to say, but so an unbelievable rejection in the harshest terms of Rabbi Reines. So you can't imagine a stronger refute, not a refutation, just saying that it's a waste of time, all this, and no one should read it, any who has any connection to Torah. Very, very strong attack on Rabbi Reines. There's one other response that I want to call your attention to in the Meshiv Dover Volume 5, and that's number 46. This is the sort of response that they would definitely censor if the censoring types got a hold of it. The question is, all mitzvot. What happens? A convert converts and he doesn't accept mitzvos. This is the big issue today. All this revoking of conversions. There's no such thing as revoking conversions. Even it's just a shorthand. What the people revoking the conversions are doing is they're saying that when the person converted, he never really accepted the mitzvos. And this is a big debate throughout Jewish history. What does it mean to accept the mitzvos? If someone says, yes, I accept the mitzvos, but I'm being honest. I'm going to tell Lashon Hara. I'm a person. I'm going to make some mistakes. Does that mean the conversion is not valid? No one would say that. Ramosha Feinstein says if someone says is ready to accept Torah and says, but I'm honest, if given the choice, give up my life or not, for one of the three big ones, I don't think I'd be able to give up my life. Well, most Jews are not able to give up their lives. So Ramosha says, of course, the conversion is valid. On the other hand, let's say he says that I'm not going to observe Shabbos. Or let's say he says, of course, I'm going to observe Shabbos, except for when, I have to travel, once every 3 months, and my job requires me at that time. Where do you draw the line? And there'd be different opinions over the generations. I my own opinion, and I've written about this, is that both sides are off. The side that's saying that this is completely new, the idea that you have to accept all the mitzvos and not, that never, say that I'm going to sin. That's completely new. It's not completely new. We had people in the past who said that. But the side that says that you have to accept all the mitzvos, and if you say you're not going to do something, it's not true. That also is incorrect. And we've had plenty of great Torah authorities who said, including Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski, who said that if people say, well, sin, te'avon, that it doesn't void the conversion. Rav Moshe Feinstein says when someone converts, don't tell them about the law that of covering the hair, because the women married women covering the hair, because they're not going to listen to it. And we have men, and Rav Uziel was famous for that. We had classes on it. So what does the Netziv say? So yeah, this is an argument that goes way back. The problem with the more strict side is that the Rambam says that the wives of Shlomo, after they converted, they still worshipped idols. But it was still a valid conversion. And the Tashbetz talks about in Spain, these people, not Spain, sorry, the Tashbetz talks about, not Spain, Tashbetz, at this time he's North Africa, he totally says that if someone converts to Judaism, and then, he's speaking about Spain. And then I forget the details. He says he goes to the church like the next day. It's still a valid conversion. That is, if you worship idolatry right afterwards, it's still a valid conversion. So, what's worth an idolatry? So we have Rishonim that say that people who just converted, what they're going to say is that, well, no, the Tashbetz has talked about a case where they accepted a Torah, but then right afterwards they decided not to. But the problem is that today everyone assumes that if right after we see that they're not observant, then when they converted they weren't observant. Historically, the liberal position was the general position. All you have to do is look at what went on in the state of Israel, the Batei Din, the people they converted. There never was an expectation that they would be completely observant. There was an expectation that they'd be traditional, but never completely observant. But what does the Netziv say? The Netziv says, no one, as far as I know, cites this Netziv, because it's sort of off the beaten track in volume 5. He says that according to the Gemara, you can only convert people if they will accept mitzvos. However, if you go ahead and convert someone and they don't accept mitzvos, it's still a valid conversion, because Kabbalah's mitzvos is not me'akev. The only thing that's me'akev, the only thing that's required is milah and tevilah. And he brings the proof from Hillel. Hillel, well, this case of Hillel, someone says, convert me while standing on one foot. The person there never accepted the mitzvos. Hillel converted him and then said, now go learn. But he hadn't converted, but the person hadn't accepted the mitzvos yet. The person didn't know about any mitzvos. And yet Hillel accepted him, as Rashi explains, because he knew that he would accept it. But he hadn't accepted it yet. So for the Netziv, that's a proof that if you hadn't accepted the mitzvos, it still is valid. He says, I'll read you something here. And so what does it say if someone says they're not going to accept the mitzvos? Ein mekablin, we don't accept them as a convert. He says, ein mekablin, eino ela she'asru akablom. That means that we're not allowed to accept them as a convert. Aval mikom akomim avru v'kibo haveger u'machrichin oso lishmor das Yisrael. But if the Beis Din nevertheless accepts the person, even if the person says, I'm not going to observe it, and of course, certainly, if the person doesn't tell them he's not going to observe it, ex post facto, it's a valid conversion. Then the Netziv raises the problem, but maybe that only applied in the days of when they had real Batei Din of what we call the Mumchim. But today, perhaps not, because the question is raised, how can we do conversions today? We're not mumchim. And the answer that Tosfos gives is that we're the shluchim of the real Batei Din. And so that Siv says, well, maybe the whole idea of us being their shluchim only applies if we do a chachila, and there is no b'di'evit converts. But then he says that the Rif and the Rambam don't agree with that. And according to the Rif and the Rambam, I'll just read it for you. And he doesn't think, he's not so clear that the Tosfos means this anyway. So he doesn't really give a conclusion. He says that the Tosfos position is difficult. He says the Gemara is clear that people who don't do mitzvos, they're still valid converts. And he says that this is the Rambam and the Rif's position. And he seems to end that this should be the way you should do. Although he doesn't say absolutely, but this seems to be what he's saying. And he says, according to the position of the Rif and the Rambam, which he thinks is the position, the Gemara's position, although he doesn't actually say at the end, halacha l'maisa, but this is his ruling, where what it should be. He says, therefore, if a Beis Din accepts people for conversion and they don't want to observe Torah, even though this Beis Din was improper, what they did, and when we, the bad Beis Din, converts this person, we've now put him in a difficult situation because now he's Jewish and he's not going to be observing Shabbos. So that's bad. Nevertheless, mikol makom have ger al pi dvar Torah. Nevertheless, he is a valid convert. As I said, no one quotes it. It's not actually true. There are a few people I saw when I searched who quote this Nitziv, and they cite him as what I just said, that this is his final position, that he doesn't really take into account the possible Tosfos position, that a conversion, even if the person does not intend to do mitzvos, is nevertheless a valid conversion. So that's interesting. Okay, a couple more things we have to do here. I see the time is flying. We spoke about the commentary on the Shiltos of the Nitziv, and he begins it. He has a lengthy essay, which is called Kidmas HaEmek, which is about Torah Sheba'al Peh, and he really presents there an entire theory of Torah Sheba'al Peh and its development. He even says that in the Golos, the Torah Sheba'al Peh was strengthened. He speaks about how people usually wonder about this. I mean, you see the Gemara, there's Pilpul, there's Chiddush, and yet if you look in Nach, you don't have any of this. Even by Rishon, they unless you're blinding yourself to the obvious facts, it's clear that people related to Torah differently in the days of Second Temple period, especially the end years of it, and in the Talmudic era, than they did in the earlier years, in the years of the First Temple. I mean, you can look in all the sources we have. So you might be called a reformer, a heretic, for saying that, that the farmers in the days of Bayit Rishon in the First Temple were not sitting and being mefalpel and everything. But the Nitziv says that. The Nitziv himself says that the whole concept of Torah study that we have, of Pilpul and Chiddush, everything we think of in yeshivas, how we learn Torah study, is only necessary and only comes to be after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, because before that, the leaders of the Jewish people were able to decide matters based on an intuition. He even goes on to say there was King Yoshiyahu who recognized that there would be a time of exile, and Yishei Torah would be necessary. But originally, you didn't have that. It was a time of intuition, the tradition was passed down, and the leaders were able to sense what was correct and tell the people. That's what the Nitziv sees. And later, however, after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, then you needed Chiddush, and it's a new way of study of Torah. I found an interesting essay on this online. Rabbi Yitzhak Blau, who's he teaches in a number of schools in Israel. He's also now a Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Oraita in the Old City. He says as follows. He says, one striking historical point deserves mention. The characters of Tanakh seem to spend less time studying Torah than do their counterparts in later Jewish history. And he says that some people will tell you, well, because Tanakh doesn't feel the need to explicitly report such study. But he says that the Nitziv's theory opens up an alternative explanation. Since in the First Temple period, Torah study was more about received traditions and intuitive rulings, it did not require the same sense of depth of involvement or time commitment. Thus, and now I'm quoting Blau, Torah study becomes a more central part of the religious Jews' routine during the Second Temple period. Those of us who experience the joy of Torah study on a daily basis can certainly express gratitude about this development. So Torah study, as we know it, is a Second Temple phenomenon beginning in the exile, the Nitziv says. I think some people might argue that it's not even a second beginning of the Second Temple period. It more develops in the later Second Temple period. But this is striking, that the Nitziv is showing this historical sense here that Judaism, and what's more fundamental Judaism, the study of Torah, that Judaism is significantly different in the First Temple than it is in the Second Temple, and that it is today. When Torah study is so central, it was not that way. And the question, therefore, is what happens in the future Messianic era? Do we go back to the First Temple model, or do we continue with what we are doing at present? I found another interesting thing. I cited this in my book, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, in the Nitziv, which also shows not just a historical sense, a critical sense. A critical sense of the sort that you think of like a David Weiss Halivni. Not a Shaul Lieberman. He was not a critical scholar in this way. He says in the commentary on the Shiltos, if you want to look at it, it's 128.1, page 63a. He says, I'll just translate it to English. It's the manner of the Gemara to contort, the word he uses a lot, came, the explanation of the Mishnah in order to bring it into line with the final halacha. Anyone who studied Gemara is aware of a phenomenon that the Mishnah says something, and by the time the Gemara is finished with it, they're saying, well, the Mishnah refers to this case, and it's some strange case. And if you have any historical sense, your question has to be, well, if that's what the Mishnah meant, why didn't the Mishnah say so? If the Mishnah said a straight blanket ruling, and then by the time you're finished with the Gemara, it means, well, only in a certain case, this and that, well, then the Mishnah, how is the Mishnah saying it as a blank ruling if they mean it in that specific case? And what the Nitziv says here, it's the manner of the Gemara to contort the explanation of the Mishnah in order to be in line with the final halacha, is that the Gemara is not telling you that's what the Mishnah really means historically. What the Gemara is saying is that we know the halacha. Halacha comes down to us for all sorts of ways, not just through the Mishnah. The halacha is X. The Mishnah is Y. If we can, we will try to bring the Mishnah into line with the halacha, even though that's not what the Mishnah meant. The Mishnah meant Y. We're making the Mishnah mean X, but this is just a way of explaining it. It's really not historically what the Mishnah meant. The Vilna Gaon recognized this, but the Vilna Gaon adopted a different approach. The Vilna Gaon said that just like in Torah, you have Pshat and Drash, the simple meaning and the homiletic meaning, he says so too in Mishnah, this Pshat and Drash. And therefore, the Gemara, when it gives these far-fetched answers to explain the Mishnah, so there's no stira between the Mishnah and the Braisa, that's the Drash. Pshat, al pi ha-Pshat, the Mishnah doesn't mean this. And That's the big question with the Vilna Gaon, not the big question, the big issue that the Vilna Gaon in his commentary on the what we have, commentary on the Mishnah, he sometimes explains the Mishnah, al pi hapshat, different than the Gemara. Well, what's going on here? If the Gemara tells you this is what the Mishnah means, how could the Vilna Gaon say the Mishnah means something different than the Gemara? The answer is because he held that there's a pshat and drash. The Nitziv is not saying this, but it's sort of the same thing. The Nitziv is saying the Mishnah means one thing. The Gemara is putting in the halacha, so we read it in the Mishnah, but that's not what the Mishnah really means. This is the sort of approach that is standard in the academic world of scholarship, where they distinguish between the Mishnah and between later explanations of the Mishnah. Which gets very complicated because sometimes you'll see the Yerushalmi offers a completely different explanation. The Yerushalmi can explain the Mishnah al pi hapshat, and the Bavli explains it differently. So at best, you can say here it's a machokas, which means that the Amoraim explaining the Mishnah are only offering a possible explanation. So I think that's quite significant. Boal, incidentally, has a number of other essays on the Haritzion website. We don't have time. Time's running out. We'll maybe 15 more minutes. You could have a number of classes on the commentary of the McDover. I'll say over a few things in it. But Blau has a number of interesting essays on there. I mean, you could see that he speaks about the Hebrew grammar is so important. Let me show you another book. Very good book. It's called Darka Shel Torah, The Path of Torah. He's translated I think it's the entire Kidmat HaEmek I just mentioned to you is translated into English now by Rabbi Elchanan Greenman, published in 2009. I was just skimming through it here to remind myself of some things to say. And he cites from Hosafon Os Dalet, the addendum to chapter 4. The Netziv says something interesting about commentary on the Torah. He says that a he says that he has an exegesis from Song of Songs. I don't know, need to go into it, how he gets to it, but he says that a Talmudic scholar, only a Talmudic scholar, can write commentaries on the Torah. And he explains that people who are not Talmudic scholars write commentaries, it leads them astray. They can even, he says, end up being a heretic and distort the verses to suit his own opinion. So the Netziv, in writing his commentary, sees it as part of what it means to be a great Torah scholar. Let me just throw out, in the time we have left, some things that I found of great interest, and maybe you will as well. These are things either I've seen over the years or just preparing for the classes I saw. Jerry Balsam, actually, if any of you know him from Manhattan, he called my attention to this one years ago, and I've always remembered it. So I don't know if you're listening to the classes, Jerry, online, but thank you. I might have uncovered it anyway, but I want to give him the credit. In Bereishis, Chavdalah 24, verses 64 and 65, he says as follows, the Netziv wants to know why Yaakov has to do this whole ruse to get the brachas from his father, Yitzhak. Why didn't Rivka's married to Yitzhak, why didn't Rivka explain who Esav really is? She saw that Esav is a problem and that Yitzhak is going to give the blessings to Esav. The Netziv asks that question. He says, didn't she do that same thing when it comes to Yishmael? She told Avraham, and she had far less standing because that wasn't her son, Yishmael. But she saw that Yishmael was trouble, so she told her husband, Avraham. So why didn't Rivka do the same thing? And he says, this is the sort of thing that only the Netziv, I think, could say this, or Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Let me read it to you so you know I'm not making it up. Says that she was afraid of Yitzhak. Here's the exact words here. She had beliba pachad. She had fear of him. Her relationship with her husband was not the same as that of Rachel and Yaakov and Sarah and Abraham. They were not afraid to speak up. Rachel was not afraid to speak up, and Sarah was not afraid to speak up. Masha ain came Rivka, not Rivka, however. Lo matzah Rivka level ha made it Yitzhak al da tan. She wasn't able to speak her mind and set him straight. Because she was, and it says, husband like Sarah and Rachel and that Cheyenne, Loya Magia, we wouldn't have to do this whole trick. But she had pachad from him. She was afraid of him. And he brings this back, he begins this derivation right when she saw him. It says, Vatisa Rivka, now she saw him, and then she fell off the camel. And she said to her, this servant, who is this man? And she, Netziv says that I'm afraid of. And it says that she had fear when she heard that he was going to be her husband. I don't know what type of scene he's imagining, but here he's giving a psychological interpretation of the sort that we're told. Varon Cutler famously says you're not supposed to, and he's analyzing the marriages and the ways of communication between the Avos and the Imos, and that Sarah and Rachel had a better marriage, and they could speak openly, and Rivka couldn't speak her mind, and because of that, she had to resort to this ruse where they trick the blind Yitzhak with the blessings. quite fascinating, I think. And if it wasn't in Civ who said it, I believe it would be regarded as quite problematic. A couple other things. I found in his commentary on Shir HaShirim in chapter 8, verse 10, it relates to things that we did prior. I should have mentioned it actually in the previous class, but I forgot. He says as follows. Ein lisrachek, I keep going back to Sephardic Ashkenazim, sorry. Ein lisrachek mi'anashim she'ena b'nei Torah. He says, we should not separate from people who are not b'nei Torah, even if they're not observing Torah. But we should try to find some, good thing about them. What he's speaking about here is the typical person who, we're not dealing with reformers or anything like that, just the typical irreligious Jew. Not even just typical religious Jew, even the one who's not observant, but he's not a heretic in the sense that he doesn't believe in God or anything. He could believe in God, but he just doesn't do any Torah, and he doesn't like the rabbis either. He has a problem, though. The Rambam and the other sources say that you're supposed to hate a heretic. And how they define a heretic? A heretic in the Gemara is one who doesn't respect the sages. And there's an obligation to hate them. He says no. He says there's no obligation to hate these people, these sinners, these Amoratzim. Even if these Amoratzim, even though these ignorant people hate the rabbis, say bad things about the rabbis, are not observant. Why not? Doesn't the Gemara say that an Apikoros is one who hates the sages and you're supposed to hate them? He says there's two types of Apikorsim. There's those types of Apikorsim that hate the rabbis and don't observe Torah. Them we're not supposed to hate. However, there's another type of Apikorsim. They're the ones who are Kofrim B'Torah V'Nevuah B'Yisrael, like atheists. Those Apikorsim, those are the ones we hate. We don't want anything to do with. But the run-of-the-mill Apikoros, that is the run-of-the-mill one who doesn't observe Torah, but not because he doesn't not believe in God. Yom Kippur, he's probably in the shul also, but he hates the rabbis. He doesn't observe Torah. Those people we're not supposed to hate. We're supposed to love them, which is interesting. Two more things. One more thing I'm not going to tell you because of the interest of time, but I don't know if any of you know this book, How Do We Know This, by Jay Harris. He talks about how the 19th century rabbis, also the medievals, understood the phenomenon of a drasha. What does it mean when you, in the Gemara, when they derive from a verse a lesson? Are they actually creating the halakha from the verse? Or is this just a tradition, and which they know, an oral tradition, and the verse doesn't create the law, but the verse, it's an asmachta, they call it, that it's just a mnemonic that to remember, but it doesn't create it. This is a debate. It has to do with it changes in modern times. The Netziv was firmly on the side of that the drashot of the rabbis are actually creating the halakha. And as Jay Harris says, anyone who looks at the Gemara, you see that's what they're doing. But the problem for many of the rabbis was that this time they were being attacked. The rabbis were being attacked. The Gemara was being attacked for, and drashot was one of the things they were attacking it for. What type of exegesis is this? An extra letter? You're going to find a halakha? And therefore, for those scholars in the 19th century, traditionalists who were sensitive to this attack, they adopt the position, which goes back to the Rambam, that really this is all an oral tradition, and the drashot are just, it's just a way of connecting the law to the Torah. But for people like the Netziv, that makes a mockery of the entire Gemara. If you look at it, he says, they're clearly deriving, and they have the authority to do that. The Ritva refers to the Rambam's view as, I think his language is dat minut, it's a heretical view. So you can, if you had more time, we'd go into it, but you can read all of that in his very insightful book. I want to mention two more things from the Netziv in his commentary on the Torah, and then just finish up with Reina Basia at one point. And I'm sorry, Gershon, I'm not going to get Gershon Heppner sent me something from Rabbi Sachs, who develops the Netziv's idea that the Torah is has to be understood as poetry, not as prose, because the words are elusive, etc., etc. Okay, just quickly, two more things. In his commentary to, actually, one more thing, I'll say. His commentary on Kitetsé, chapter 22, verse 7, he speaks about why there seems to be two contradiction. It says about Kibbutz Av Em, honoring your father and mother, that your life will be long. And then it says, and by when it comes to Shiruach, you're sending away the mother bird, it says, I forget now. It's the opposite. They turn it around. What goes living long or not? I forget. But that's not important for now. I'd have to look that up. He raises the question that you have two contradictory passages in the Talmud. One, it seems to be contradictory. One says, "Yafasha achash shakaras ruach b'olam ba." It's better to be a tiny bit of time in the world to come from this entire world. And but it also says it's better 1 hour in this world, where you can do mitzvos, than the entire world to come. That's in Masechet Shabbos. So what is it? Wait a second. How could it be both? First, he says it's better to 1 hour in the world to come is better than this entire world. And then he says, but one, then it says in the Mishnah, 1 hour in this world where you do mitzvos is better than the entire world to come. The Nitziv explains as follows. Depends why you're doing mitzvos, he says. If you're doing mitzvos, if your whole point of doing mitzvos is to receive reward, then of course it's better in the world to come. However, but if you're doing it from its own sake, let me read you his exact language from Ava. If you ovei me'ava, v'atayra'ilo ruchos yamin bo'amazeh, zeh ucharo. Yosher Michael Mava. But if you're doing the mitzvahs not for the reward, you're doing it for the sake of doing it, because that's the right way to live and that's the proper thing, then of course you don't care about Olam Haba. That's not what you want. You want to be here because that's you want to perform mitzvahs. And it's a wonderful I think explanation of the difference between two types of observant Jews. Those for whom the Torah is a bag of goodies, trying to give you some sort of ticket to the next world, and that this is the mitzvahs is just a path there, and whatever you're commanded, you do it because you want the reward. And those who actually see something positive in the actual doing of it, and it's so much so that the Vilna Gaon is said that he would give up. Reuven quotes him saying this: he doesn't even want his Olam Haba. He'd give the whole thing away because he wants the ability to actually do the mitzvah for the sake of the mitzvah, just from Avas Hashem. Like the servant without, like the servant without being rewarded. And so that the Nitziv gives a very important way, an approach there. And, okay, my final thing I want to say, it's really not relevant so much to the Nitziv, but I guess it is his wife, his first wife, because she's famous. I wrote about this. Some of you have seen it, but let me, in 3 or 4 minutes, explain to you for those who don't remember. The Nitziv's first wife, whose name is Reina Basia, is famous because the Nitziv's nephew records a whole conversation, more than one conversation he has with her, and she's shown to be a great Torah scholar, even though she's a woman. Today, maybe isn't so unusual, but in those days, it definitely was unusual, who knows all different aspects of Torah. And the Torah Tamim, or Baruch Epstein, had long conversations with her, so he tells us about all sorts of matters, and you see how she was offended by certain negative things said about women in the Talmud, and she tried to give arguments explaining, the role of women, all these sorts of things. And this whole dialogue fascinated many people because here we have testimony in the 19th century in a small shtetl in Volozhin. the wife of the Rosh Yeshiva, who's like a proto-feminist and is putting forth all sorts of arguments about how women also have a connection to Torah. And as I said, people were fascinated, and a number of articles came out analyzing this whole interesting phenomenon of this woman before her time. And I believe that, the culmination of this is when Reina Bassia pulls out this rare sefer called Mayan Ganim, in which the rare sefer mentions how women can learn Torah if they want to, and the whole story. I believe, and I've written that it's not true, that this whole the story is not true. You know, in general, the Makor Baruch or Baruch Epstein, his memoirs, he takes a lot of liberties with the truth. Obviously, Reina Bassi was an unusual person. You couldn't have written it about her, but everyone knew who she was. But the whole story, the whole description of her is, I've argued, is incorrect. It never happened. And the whole story, the thing with the Mayan Ganim is completely false. You can look at my article and you can see that the Reb Baruch Epstein himself never had the work. He was citing from a selection of it that appeared in a Hebrew newspaper called Atzfira, because you see that he leaves out the mistakes that appear in Atzfira also appear in what he what he has. What I believe is that Reb Baruch Epstein created this whole story, and he is putting his own ideas in the mouth of Reina Bassia. That he's arguing for a more enlightened approach to women's issues through the mouth of Reina Bassia, it seems. It seems to me, at least, that this is not historical. And I even brought a proof from Rav Chaim Hirschenson, a letter from the Torah Tamima, in one of Rav Chaim Hirschenson's writings, and I think you can see that we're not dealing with actual history. As a postscript to this, there was another rabbi named Chaim Heichel Greenberg, and he tells the story that he went to see Rav Chaim Ozer, and he asked him, how can the Beis Yaakov girls learn Torah, everything? And what does Rav Chaim Ozer do? He reaches behind the shelf, and he pulls out again this rare book, Mayan Ganim, and he cites this this Mayan Ganim, which, by the way, is not even a book of halacha, which then it's a... if you look in the Torah Tamima, he thinks it's a book of halacha. This is like a theme, this which is not really historically accurate, I believe. The Torah Tamima is the one himself who created this idea that this book, Mayan Ganim, is a book of responsa, that it says that women can study Torah if they really want to, when it's not a book of responsa at all. It's a book of... it's a book of letters to teach you how to write letters with a good Hebrew form. He knew that later on, by the time he wrote his memoir, he knew it, but he didn't know it when he wrote the Torah Tamim, it seems. Okay, let me go read some questions, do some questions for 10 minutes or so. Let me just make a note for myself. And then we'll say goodnight. I have to say, it's been great again. I was supposed to go 7 times. We went 8 times. But we will be together again soon, God willing, with some other classes I'm going to give. I learned, as always, from the questions and from the comments and from the challenges. But before we say goodnight, let me just end with some comments here. Yes, Chaim says Seattle Mikvah used municipal water. You can see an article on Mark Angel's journal, Conversations, a whole very interesting article by him, not Mark Angel, although he's from that town, by Rabbi Azos, that speaks about this. That was one of the last ones. That continued up into the 1970s. But it wasn't just there. It was in all over Morocco, it was the case. It was not in New York, but it was in the heartland of America. It was in England. It was everywhere. It was in Italy. It was in Turkey. People today don't believe you if you tell them that that's the truth. What is my level of Yiddish proficiency? I can read German, so I can make my way through. 75%. I would say 75%. 75% reading, and listening too. Yeah. Chaim Eiselman says there's a Hasidic story about dogs which surrounded schnapps, which was sold. The dogs protected the Jews' money from being pilfered. Okay. But check it out, Chaim. Check out the story in the Shaarei Tshuva. The only reason I think that it would be acceptable to hide the key is because the man who bought the chametz, it was understood by both sides that he really wasn't buying it. It was just a legal fiction, even though technically he could. If this was a real sale and you really were selling him, how could you steal his? How could you remove the keys from him? Remember, Kefet Mel says has told the sign story many times. Yes, I've heard it, but now we see it's a real story. I don't know if our Kefet knows. He act Rabbi Vitterwitz, who was a Talmud Chacham, a Chabad, he actually did call himself the chief rabbi. So I thank Chaim for pointing it out. Lawlessness, yes, lawlessness, correct, Baruch, is not a good translation. Revolutionary activity. Did Meller hear that? No, Meller got it from Stamfer's book. Yes, Chaim asks, were many Maskilim observant in Lithuania? Sure. Many Maskilim in Lithuania were observant. Maskilim were like modern Orthodox. They were intellectuals in Lithuania, many of them, not in other places. Mark, yes, when I hold it up something for us, leave it for a couple of seconds. You're right. I should. Thank you. Okay, Rev. I think Ephraim Shach had one son and one daughter. If the son, it's famous stories. The grandson who was a of Rav Shach, who was a soldier, used to come to Panevezh, and he'd come into the Beis Medrash. The people didn't know who this was. He'd come up to his grandfather would give him a big hug and kiss. I think it's one son and one daughter. Yeah. Sorry, Chaim, this is Reb Bamberger from Aschaffenburg. There's a few Bambergers. I don't know. You have to check which if it's Aschaffenburg or Kitzingen. The one from Aschaffenburg wrote his own tshuvas also. I think it was called Netiyah Shel Simcha. You can see on HebrewBooks.org. Rabbi Bamberger had another son who was a dayan in the Hirshian community, and apparently, at least Mordechai Breuer thought there was an anonymous pamphlet defending Hirsch in the dispute against Bamberger, and Breuer claimed, I don't know how he knows this, but it's a tradition, that that was written by Rabbi Bamberger's own son. Hard to believe, but it's there. And the grave, I believe we saw it when we were in Frankfurt. Next time, Mel, we can make the chat smaller. Yeah, Rav Shach had three children. One died, you're right. Yeah, one died young. So we have the whole story here from Chaim. Dr. Ephraim Shach was in the Israel Defense Force. Received a doctor in history from Bernard Revel Graduate School. That's what it says. The problem is that I believe I checked this once, and I couldn't find as. I know they say it's a doctorate in history, but I don't know if it's really a doctorate in history, even though they say that. It might not be. And remember, YU used to have a lot of doctorates, which were, they were not PhDs. They were DHLs. And I don't know if they're all available at Dissertation Express. But okay, you got Shmuel says that the Rebbe, Lubavitcher Rebbe, was known to tell Rabbanim and other Rebbes they can override a directive of their relatives to not print manuscripts, which is exactly what they did in Jerusalem and what the Netziv said. The Netziv, the only reason he went said that show it to other rabbis is because he had heard that he was concerned that maybe there's some maybe a radical halachic ruling, but in general, it wasn't a problem. Len says that he recalls Rav Gershuni did that in Kol Tzafayach. I don't know what Rav Gershuni did in Kol Tzafayach, so you have to remind me. Rav Gershuni, we're talking about Rav Yehuda Gershuni, Rav Yehuda Grudner, who the son of Rav Eliezer Silver, really great, great Torah scholar who never really made it. I'm not sure why. He was the equal of all the great Rabbanim of his generation. Maybe because he didn't have a beard. I don't know the reason. But okay. Are there writings of the Aruch HaShulchan that say that have not been published? The last writings of the Aruch HaShulchan were published. That's the last volume of Aruch HaShulchan itself, and also his Drashot, which were published about 20 years ago. Is the family apparently said, says they don't have stuff from the Netziv has not been published. Of course, we don't know if they would reveal it if they did. They did publish. You know, we do the volume 5 was the last thing that was published. Oh, I also want to say one more thing. He showed me that in the Machzikei Hadas, that the famous responsible of the Netziv dealing with right and left, where he says against separatism, it first appeared. I said it had to have appeared early, but I didn't know that it was in the actual Machzikei Hadas. It appeared in the Machzikei Hadas journal. And if you look in the last, and on HebrewBooks.org, if you look at the last issue of it, where it has, I can, anyone interested, I can send you the exact link. There's a note from the editor, because at the end, if you recall, the Netziv says some negative things against Hasidim, which were censored in the edition I have. And the editor says he criticizes the Netziv for speaking disrespectfully about the Hasidim. Yes, the Netziv Baruch did not go along with the Brisker Derech. So he rejected both ways, of course. Yes, Chaim, it's true. The Gemara does portray King David as learning and, you know, all these sorts of things. Whether the Netziv would say that he's the exception or this is just a way of inspiring people, the Maritz Chayis would see this as a sort of, he talks about how you know, the great people of our past in Tanakh, both the good ones and the bad ones, become archetypes of how we're supposed to live our lives. So for instance, when you have a story in the Talmud, a negative story about Esav, it's not really about the historical Esav. Esav is the archetype of evil. Even he, for the Gemara, is Rome, and that's how the Maritz Chayis explains it. So you could say the same thing. King David has shown, you know, doing Kopulim, that this can be seen as the archetype of how we're supposed to live our life. I don't know if that's what the Netziv would say. That's what the Maritz Chayis would say. Okay, all of you. Yes, Shmuel Archivolti. Thank you very much. Yes, it's in my post on the Sforim blog, all about the Mayan Ganim. Jay Kelman tells us that at 11 a.m., that'll be tomorrow, I guess, insights on Egyptology on the Haggadah. And I'll just end because Baruch asks me. Oh, before I get to Baruch, Len says, Rishuni said that after long and detailed discourse that Muslims and Christians don't apply at Halacha Maisa. Okay, yeah, it's a good question what he meant in that. Baruch said, any comment on the passing of Professor Helmreich, author of the classic, The World of the Yeshiva? Professor Helmreich, for those who are interested, if you go to HebrewBooks.org, although it's Hebrew books, but if you put in his name in English, it'll take you to the interviews he did. For the book, World of the Yeshiva, he interviewed many of the leading Rosh Yeshiva, and he used those interviews to write his book. But the actual texts of the interviews, which were in his possession, he put it online a few years ago, and you can see it now on HebrewBooks.org. They're very interesting. I spent last Pesach with Professor Helmreich, and he gave a wonderful talk on, he wrote, in addition to his Jewish stuff, he wrote, I think, two books, one for Manhattan, one for Brooklyn, maybe three, I don't know. He walked every single street in Manhattan and every street, I think it's in Brooklyn. He wrote a book walking every street in Manhattan. Quite prolific. He gave a wonderful talk, and we made a deal. He was going to come speak in Scranton, and he's supposed to come speak in Scranton on May 7th. I think it's May 7th. So I emailed him. Our university closed just last Thursday. I got an email that my university is closed for the whole semester. At first, we were supposed to open up April 20th. but now we're closed for the entire semester. So on last Thursday, I emailed Bill Helmreich telling him we're going to have to cancel. He didn't reply to me. I figured, he doesn't need to reply. I'm telling him we're canceled. I'll get around to it. We're all crazy this time with what's going on. I heard Motzei Shabbos that he passed away. So obviously on Thursday, he must have been already quite ill. So, it's a big loss and a big disappointment. And I had no idea. I was just sending him an email on Thursday telling him that we're going to have to cancel. I said we're going to cancel, but we'll have a makeup. We'll make it up. Take a rain check. So the plan was that in the fall, God willing, everything is good, the fall of 2020, he'd come and give his talk. And the talk that he was supposed to give was, he has a talk on which I haven't heard. I don't know if it's online, but he explained it to me. And I thought that would be good for my audience, which is both lay people and people at university, on Jewish stereotypes, the truths and untruths behind Jewish stereotypes, typical Jewish stereotypes of money and all the different things, control of the world. So that was the talk he was supposed to give. And it's very unfortunate. So thank you for asking me about that, Baruch. And for everyone, good night. Thank you again for a good semester. And maybe we'll see you later in this week, where I'll be dealing with Kitnios, historical aspects, the sort of stuff we do. Even if we don't focus on Gedolim, we'll focus on Gedolim and all sorts of interesting things. So thank you all very much. Yes, Baruch, you wrote the book, The Things on Your Back.